11:22. Let's go there today, shall we? Not that you guys get a say in it, because that's the one I studied. So if you don't want to do this one, then you're not getting one. So 11:22 is where we're going. Hope you like it. Hope I haven't done it before. If I have, just nod and smile. Okay, somebody read that. Or discretion, either way, however you want to say it. We're flexing here. A ring of gold and a swine's snout. So kind of an odd combo of things, right? So sorry, ladies, we're going to hammer on you a little bit and then hammer on the guys for a little bit. What do you think of when you think of a gold ring and the snout of a pig? Do you think, boy, what a beautiful pig? Or do you think, boy, what a waste, right? You think, what a waste, right? The external ornamentation does not make up for what's happening on the internal, right? And it's compared to a woman, specifically a female, right, who lacks discretion, okay? The word for discretion in Hebrew is the word ben, and it literally means taste, okay? It's the ability to, well, why would that word be used? Taste. What do your taste buds have the ability to do? Yeah, sense what? Yeah, if I stick vinegar in your mouth, you're going to react one way as opposed to an Oreo, right? You have the ability to discern. That is good. That is God awful, right? That is filthy and that is wonderful, or whatever your illustrations may be, okay? It's compared to a woman who does not have that discernment, doesn't have the ability to discern good from bad. So the idea is there's no morality about her. There's no godliness about her. So to put beautiful ornamentation on a pig is the same as saying, wow, there is a trophy wife that has zero internal qualities that make her able to be adorned with such external qualities, right? Okay. Now, gentlemen, why would this be written about women? Why is the comparison not written about a man in terms of that and been pointed at a woman? Why is that a warning to guys? To look out for that, right? Why do guys need to look out for that? How many times have you seen some gal with some smoking hot dude? That sounds odd for me to say out loud. Sorry. Dave, if you could go ahead and edit that last part that I said, that'd be great. We don't need that to go public. Thanks. Okay, we're good. We're good. Could be worse. I have nightmares about cussing in the pulpit. I don't know if you guys have ever, yeah. So just like, just one day something's going to slip out and you're going to go, oh, never get that back. So, okay. So it could be worse. You don't normally see gals fall prey to the idea of that guy's got horrible character. He's a jerk, but I'm going to marry him because of his external qualities, right? Gals will tend to marry some fat old rich guy, right? With a big beer belly, who's like 97 and is like got one foot in the grave, okay? But guys are susceptible to the opposite of that, right? I don't care if the inside's rotten. If the externals look great, right, guys can be susceptible to those things. So it's interesting that that is important. It's specifically at men to be careful of women who are like that, okay? So, gentlemen, for those of you guys that are in the single world, I think most of you have your wits about you and you're not looking for, you know, a pig with a ring in its nose, okay? Most of you, I think, have your bearing set to where you are looking for girls, and rightly so, with great qualities about them, and that's noble, okay? But be aware of that, especially for you guys that are pouring into the lives of others, right? Younger guys, right? This is a, man, it's a temptation for everybody, okay? Looks do not cancel out character, okay? Our pastor at home used to say, how did he phrase it? Character is always ugly in the dark. You turn out the lights, right? You can't see outside anymore, and character is always ugly in the dark, something like that. He was much more eloquent as he communicated that than I was, but you get the idea, all right? Ladies, so most of you, I think, all of you, to my knowledge, do not fit this. So for those of you guys that are pouring into the lives of women, make sure that they are adorning their insides. And there's nothing wrong with adorning the outside, but make sure that they are not women of this type of reputation, all right? So thoughts on that as we move on. Just wanted to, a shot across the bow, make sure that we were all headed in the right direction in terms of marriage and such. So, thoughts on that. Maybe from a personal note, as you guys think through marriage, obviously godliness is this really big category. If I had to hang my hat on two things that matter in marriage, assuming that godliness is there, it's humility and teachability. And if your spouse does not have those things, you are screwed, for lack of a better godly word. Okay, so as you think through a spouse one day, you want someone that's humble, that isn't first in their own eyes, okay? And you want someone who has the ability to be teachable. Simple as that. That can learn, that can grow, that can go, you know what? I screwed that up. I need to learn. I need to say I'm sorry. I need to get better in that area. And if those two qualities are evident in a spouse, you'll go a long way. When those things are not part of the game, then it tends to be very, very difficult to engage in conflict, to have, you know, marital bliss, to get through things that are rough, because all marriages have stuff. At least mine does, and I produce most of it, but that's the reality of it. So I'm very, very grateful that I married a girl that had those qualities about her, and 15 years later, they are as evident as they were the day that I married her. And I was 23 and dumb and was very, very lucky to end up with a gal of my wife's character. And I don't even know that I knew what I was looking for, but thank God God did and put me in the right spaces to run into her. So, okay. So as you guys think through that, just a couple things that I would... Those are the two qualities that I've seen over time in my bride that are irreplaceable. So, okay, everything else changes and gets older, and right, our bodies change. All that stuff gets, it goes where it goes, right? We just get older. But with those two things, specifically on the internal, humility and teachability, okay? There you are. Cool? All right, Leviticus, shall we? Okie dokie. Raven, will you pray for us this morning as we dive back into Nadab and Abihu? And then we will get into it. Thank you. Amen. All right. So yesterday, you guys did a great job breaking down the text. We saw chapters 1 through 7, the offerings of Leviticus. Okay, so we kind of set up the scene there. Now, 8 and following, we're seeing a shift from just kind of the giving of ordinances in regards to offerings to now a bit of some historical context, right? So the tabernacle set up, the ordinances of how we're going to operate in the tabernacle have been given with all the sacrifices and the way those are going to go down. And then in chapter 8, we're beginning to consecrate the priests and the tabernacle itself. We're getting everything ready. We finished in chapter 8 with the idea of Aaron, his four sons, Eleazar, Itamar, Nadab, and Abihu, have all been set aside along with Aaron. They've been consecrated. They've been in the holy place for 7 days. They've spent a week in there getting ready to now minister before the people and before God. Okay, chapter 9 is going to feel almost like a repeat of chapter 8. Okay, so we're going to see a lot of the same things done again. The idea being that part of this was for the inauguration for the first event of the tabernacle. We're going to get it ready, and then they're going to go through the normative process of getting ready to perform their priestly services. So if you think about it, big picture, this was a process that when the priests came in to minister before the Lord, they would have gone through this process every time they had to get ready to minister. Okay, the seven-day process was kind of a one-time deal, but in terms of getting ready to perform their duties throughout history, this would have been normative. Okay, so as you look at chapter 9, just keep that in mind. All right. So again, they've now been there for 7 days. Chapter 9, verse 1. Let's pick up here and see kind of what God calls Aaron and his sons and Moses as well to do. Chapter 9, 1. Let's pick up there. I mean, that's a lot of stuff, right? You continue to see just the gravity of the situation, the amount of stuff that they have to bring. I mean, I don't know what that is in our terms, but boy, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of substance, that the material goods that matter to these people. Okay, so this is what, again, not a trite thing. This was a costly thing. God is demanding, again, their first and their best. And you're seeing, I think, four different offerings mentioned just in those three verses of chapter 9 after they've already done kind of the initial inauguration of the tabernacle. Okay, you get a neat nugget here in verse 6 in terms of kind of the role of the priest. Moses said, "This is the thing which the Lord commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you." So you do these things right, and God will be in your midst. He's going to be in your presence. God's glory is going to show up, and you're going to interact with him on a right way. Okay? So verse 7, Moses said to Aaron, "Come near to the altar of your offering, of your sin offering, that you and your burnt offering, that you may make atonement for yourself and for the people. Then make offering for your people, that you may make atonement for them, just as the Lord commanded." So the idea is, first you get right, okay, again, and then for the people. Verse 8, we see that there. Aaron came near to the altar, slaughtered the calf for the sin offering, which was for himself. Okay, so again, sin offering. What was that? We talked a little bit about it yesterday. You can look on the board. What was the idea behind the sin offering? Unintentional sin. So this is the catch-all, like, okay, you've confessed what you know. This is the rest of the stuff, okay? We mentioned it yesterday, and there were a couple that were this way, but what was unique, or one of the things that the priest got to do with the sin offering? They ate a portion of it, okay? We saw that with a couple, and there was one where the offerer got to eat part of it. Okay, there's just one, the peace offering maybe? Three of them the priest ate, and then there's one that the offerer got to eat. Anyway, so today, just keep that in mind, okay? You'll need to know that in chapter 10, okay? So the sin offering, part of the process was to eat the offering. So literally, it's like the guy at McDonald's cooking your hamburgers, having a hamburger. You know, you ate it in the sanctuary, you made the offering, and then you ate inside the tabernacle, right? That was their food, okay? So, and it's just as important to God that they ate the offering, or a portion of the offering that was a part of the process, as the putting it on the altar and going through all the other stuff as well. Okay, so that's a piece of the puzzle, okay? So verse 8, Aaron offers the sin offering for himself. Aaron's sons presented in verse 9 the blood to him. He dipped his finger in the blood, put some of the horns of the altar. This would have been, the external altar on each of the four horns that were there, and go from there, okay? 10 and following, just again, as a reminder, the fat, the kidneys, the lobe of the liver, and the sin offering he offered up in smoke on the altar just as the Lord had commanded. So the things that are put on the external altar out there are burned up, they're consumed. So with the sin offering, that would have been everything. The flesh and the skin in verse 11 were burned outside the camp. Okay, so the things that were considered not as holy, they're not unclean, but they are differentiated between the fat and the muscle itself and the meat of the sacrifice. Those are burned outside the camp. Okay, so keep that imagery in your head of what's inside and kind of what's outside. Okay, Aaron's sons go through the same process in verse 12. They get clean again, and then verse 15. They presented the people's offering. They took the goat for the sin offering, which was for the people. They slaughtered it and offered it for sin. Okay, so we'll talk more about kind of the New Testament language with this idea of offerings when we get back and tie it into one of the verses or one of the chapters in Leviticus that we'll get to. But just the idea of what that represented and how the New Testament pictures kind of this concept of the sacrificial lamb or ram or whatever it may be. Okay, so you guys get the idea. This is the whole deal. So chapter 9, they're doing it again. So we've spent now a week getting ready. On the eighth day, they offer basically all the same sacrifices that they offered in chapter 8, again in chapter 9. It's been a big ordeal, okay, all to get this thing going. So we're 8 days into this thing, 9 days into this thing, and in chapter 10, we're actually going to start the first ever process of using the tabernacle formally on a daily basis, okay? Now, when we've seen first in Scripture, in people that are commanded to do something, and they are the first ones to do it, okay? How does God normatively treat those individuals? What is his expectation? Think Nadab and Abihu, not Nadab and Abihu, think Acts 2, Ananias and Sapphira. You're going to make an offering, you're going to be the first person to sell property, and you're going to make a statement about whatever issue, about how you handled said property. Yeah, almost to a degree higher than he expects it in the future. Not maybe that's not a safe. He assumes that all the time, But the punishment tends to be much more severe if it is mishandled. Okay, as a reminder, this is always my standard. I may not enact justice in a way that I have the right to every time, but this is my expectation. Okay, so keep that in mind. Chapter 10, we're going to see now Aaron and his two oldest sons, are going to be ministering before the Lord in the tabernacle for the first time. Okay, so chapter 10, verse 1, pick up there. All right, so Nadab and Abihu, again, these are the first and second born sons of Aaron. They take their fire pans and put fire on them and placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, okay? Do you guys remember the picture of the tabernacle that I showed you guys last week? There was the altar on the outside and that replica model, and leaning up against that altar, I don't know if you noticed, it was like a shovel, a bronze shovel. That's what they're using, okay? So think of maybe an oversized frying pan, or some type of like small shovel that you would take the ashes from the carcass that had been burning. You would take those hot ashes and you would bring those into the holy place. Okay, not the Holy of Holies, but the holy place. And you would take the ingredients that God had prescribed, by the way, in Exodus chapter 30. He says this is exactly what incense you are to use. You place them on the pan with the fire and that would burn, just like an incense candle, the same idea. And it would smell a certain way, and you would put that on the altar of incense inside. Okay, so that's what they're doing. They're taking what's outside, the offering's been made, the fire's going, it's rolling, and now they're bringing it inside, they're performing their duties. Okay, but you notice in verse 1, how does it describe the fire that they brought? Strange, okay? Unauthorized, I think, is one of the translations. Anyone else got a different reading of verse 1? Strange fire. So they've done something incorrectly, okay? The text doesn't tell us exactly what they've done. We'll see maybe a hint later on in the chapter as to what they could have done, but this is God's response, verse 2.
The fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord.
Wow, okay? God writes stories maybe different than I would. There's the climax, okay? Boom, they're dead. It's like, okay, well, what just happened? So verse 2, game over, okay? So they've done something wrong, whether it was they didn't read correctly in Exodus 30 what they were supposed to put in. That's a possibility. And maybe they made cupcakes instead of, fruit. I don't know. They did something incorrectly, and now we got the smell of, cookies instead of, I have no idea. Okay, but that's possible. And there's the idea of had not commanded them in verse 1, that may be leaning towards the idea that they got the ingredient list wrong, or in verses 9 and following, we'll look at that in a second, and then God's reaction will be, he offers a warning that seems to maybe not fit unless the context is clear, okay? So, it's intentional in that they're sloppy. Does that make sense? So something about them was like, either this ingredient list is not that important, or there was a reason why they were sloppy, okay? And I'll show you that in a second, okay? So you're Aaron. What are you thinking right now? It's the three of you in there, okay? And your two oldest sons just died, like, bam. And it was clearly God that killed them. This came from the Lord, right? The Shekinah glory is above the tabernacle, and now your sons get consumed in the fire, and they're gone, okay? How do you respond? Yeah, like, I just put yourself in Aaron's shoes for a second, okay? Moses now says to Aaron, by those who came near, it is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored. So that's Moses' very gentle, understanding, harmonizer response. His response is, your sons should have treated God as holy. They got what they deserved. Like, dude, I'm doing my job. I'm ministering before the Lord. My kids are dead, and that's Moses' response, right? That's a very honest response. So whatever Moses witnessed, he said, yep, those kids got what they deserved. They did something incorrectly, and God took their lives. Okay, what do you see Aaron's response? End of verse 3.
Silence.
Why would Aaron be silent? Put yourself in the position of a dad right now. Potentially, okay.
Is it because God already knows your heart, so he already knew that they're a small bee?
For sure, in that they were, but why would Aaron not step up and defend his sons? Because he knows they're right, right? He's not arguing. He's not saying, but they. You see no rebuttal from Aaron. So you get the impression that he's clearly grieved, his sons are dead, but he responds in a way to say, you know what? Okay, right? Now, this story continues to get more and more interesting as we proceed. Aaron's silent, okay? Now, verse 4, watch what Moses does. So he gets Aaron's nephews and says, you guys come in, take the dead bodies, carry them outside the camp. Why outside the camp? He's illustrating how useful they are to God at this point. Because of their disobedience, you take them outside the camp. We'll see other texts. Well, read in verse 5. Keep going there, Melissa.
So they came near and carried them in their coats out of the camp, as Moses had said.
Okay, so they carry them outside. We'll see other places where, I don't think it's in here, where the clothes are still holy. Now, these guys are toasty, but if someone were to die, they would take the garments off and reuse them. It's not the garments that the problem, right? It's the priests themselves that had the issue, okay? So they're carried outside the camp. They're deposited, okay? Verse 6, how about this command? Moses is hard. So he says, don't let your hair down so that you may not die. What is Moses saying to Aaron? Don't mourn. Why not? Why does he say, you do not have permission to mourn for your kids right now? Absolutely. What you're doing right now is far more important than you stopping and going to your kid's funeral. You see the context of how big this is? We spent 7 days getting ready for this, making sacrifices, and you guys sat in here for a week to minister before me. Then on the eighth day, we did it all over again. So we are 8 days of sacrifice and praying and preparation. These two kids, I mean, verse 1 get it wrong. God kills them, and he reminds Aaron, this is a big deal, okay? And Moses reminds him of that as well. What else would mourning have involved? If Aaron is going to go mourn for his kids properly, what would he have to do? He would have to leave the tent of meeting, right? And go be, what we'll find out, is unclean because he's now going to be around dead bodies, okay? Or in the proximity of them. And he would have to stop his duties, which means what? God's saying between the two kids that you have and the 1.5 million people in the wilderness that you are leading and helping present to me, they're far more important, so you may not mourn, okay? So you talk about a tough job description right now. Aaron's in it, okay?
Is Aaron the high priest at
that time? Yep, he's the guy.
He's the only one who can go into the Holy Holies.
He's it. Nobody else, okay? So he's the only guy that can go in the Holy Holies. Now, this isn't the day to do that, okay? It's 1 day a year, and we'll see that coming in Leviticus, but they're not doing that today. But he's the only guy that can lead, okay? Now, did you notice who got called off the bench in verse 6? Eleazar and Itamar. Who are those guys? Third and fourth born son. How are you feeling about bringing your other two kids in right now if you're Aaron? Like, whoa. Bring somebody else. How about the cousins that you just called to carry out the dead bodies? Can they come in? Like, he's in a rough spot right now. So this is a tough situation. And God's setting the standard high. Again, they're the first ones to do it. And he's not to be trifled with. Okay? Verse 6, or verse 7 rather, you get even more of the idea of what's happening. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die, for the Lord's anointing oil is upon you. You are doing your job. If you step foot outside this gate, you will die as well, just like your sons. Okay, so strong warning. Okay, now here's This seems out of context unless it's in context. Okay, Jane, pick up there in verse 9, and let's see what God says now to Aaron regarding kind of a new regulation. Now, why would God say to Aaron right now, don't drink wine or strong drink when you come into the tent of meeting? You could mess something up, i.e., you with me? So, were they just careless in reading the text, or were they inebriated, and they came in, and they're performing their priestly duties drunk? Now, can you imagine the equivalent of that today? Can you imagine Brad walking into the pulpit at the 7 o'clock service and had 4 glasses of wine at dinner with his wife and then comes in here and he's like, "Woo!" I can't think of a, like, that's the equivalent. Can you imagine the horror and go, oh my God, like, there's nothing worse than that, right? You think that would be pretty obvious. Like, you wouldn't have to say, like, I don't think the elders have ever said to Brad, hey, by the way, okay, just in case this isn't clear, you probably shouldn't do that. That's never going to be a problem. But that's the idea. So there, the many commentators think because of that, these guys were drunk, ministering before the Lord, and God went, wow, 8 days of getting ready, and you haven't figured out how serious I am?
If they were inside the whole time, where did they get the wine?
Well, it's part of the, okay. You think part of the festivals, what's Passover, right? Wine, and, I mean, that was a normative part of how they interacted. So to say, don't drink, and notice, it doesn't say, don't drink wine ever. It says don't drink wine when you're ministering before the Lord, okay? So when you're doing your priestly duties, don't drink beforehand. Man, if you're off, you're off, and make those decisions.
Between the inauguration, 7 days, and the time where they started the offerings, were they allowed to leave?
It seems like it, yeah. After that seventh day, they were allowed to go, and then they would have gone through all this again. So I'm assuming that part of this, maybe in the text that's not mentioned, would have been wine. Okay, and again, wine is water in that culture. It was a much more normative for them, and it was a part of the religious ceremonies. So to say that a priest couldn't drink would be foolish, because then they can't participate in Passover. You know, there are 4 cups of wine that you have to drink during Passover. If you guys, it's crazy, right? And not 4 like 16-ounce cups of wine, but there were, and this is a long, you know, potentially 6-hour dinner, so, you know, this isn't like they're at McDonald's for 30 minutes and knocking back 4 cups of wine. Different, okay? Not that you drink wine at McDonald's, but whatever. As far as I know, yes, okay? But you get the idea. So my take, I lean towards the fact, yeah, these guys were probably tipsy and took the things that God had said lightly, and God said, you know what, we're done, okay? Apparently Aaron wasn't, okay? So he was handling himself responsibly. He's silent in the matter when God takes his kids and Moses says, hey, they got what they deserved. Aaron kind of nods his head and says, yeah, okay? Now remember, we've just brought in kids 3 and 4 now into the picture, okay?
Is this possibly another example of, like, the dad not stepping up and leading the sons to do what's right? Would he have been with his sons?
Yeah. They're clearly working together, so maybe. Maybe Aaron didn't know.
This point is what would have been expected. They would have been in manhood, though, so they wouldn't necessarily be under their father's authority. Like, they, like, still their dad.
They're old enough to know better. You think that they would have had a, yeah. So still underneath his authority, but they're men, right? Now, we're going to contrast the first part of this chapter with the back half. So I want you just to see how the rest of this plays out. So again, you're in Aaron's shoes. You want to mourn. You can't. Your 2 kids are dead. The last thing you want to do is bring kids 3 and 4 into the mix, right? When you're, that's it. That's Aaron's family. That's all he's got, okay? So we got an odd deal, okay? 9 and following, I want you to notice, 9, 10, and 11, we read it, but this is the job description of the priest, okay? You cannot drink wine or strong drink because... Verse 10, your job is to make distinction between the holy and the profane, or the clean and the unclean. Your job as a priest is to discern what is clean and what is unclean. Now, we're going to spend some time this morning looking at chapters full of clean and unclean. So we'll talk more about that, but just note to self, that is their job, and we'll talk more about that job description, but that's it. That is your role, okay? And you're going to teach, verse 11, the sons of Israel all the statutes what the Lord God has spoken through Moses, okay? So you're going to help them discern, this is clean, this is unclean, and I'm going to teach you the 613 commandments and make sure that you know them. That's the priest's job, and you can't do that when you're intoxicated, okay? So, now, verse 12, we're going to pick up right where we left off, God says, right? We're in the middle of offering sacrifices in the temple or the tabernacle, and we're not stopping just because two guys died, so let's keep going, and we shall as well. Verse 12, so we'll pick up there. All right, so you get the idea, okay? You're going to finish doing the offering, specifically the grain offering. They get to eat a portion of the grain that was offered this day, and that's their due. That is their right. That is their that's their food, okay? Verse 14, the breast of the wave offering, however, and the thigh of the offering, you may eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you, for you have been given it as your due. So they go through all that. Verse 16, though, something changes. Read that. Wait a second. Now, they offer the sin offering, and Moses is looking for the goat of the sin offering, but had been burned up, and he's angry. Now, why is he angry? I thought the sin offering was to be consumed, right? What was the unique piece of the sin offering that we just read? For what?
To eat.
To eat. So Moses is saying, where's the rest of it? I see that the sin offering has been offered. Where is the priest's portion? Like, what happened last time? Like, 3 minutes ago, when the two sons of Aaron failed to obey God to the full, they died, right? What did Eleazar and Ithamar, they died, sorry, Nadab and Abihu were the first. These two guys, Eleazar and Ithamar, just did, in a sense, the exact same thing. God said do 100%, and they did 90. First two sons died, okay? God says do 100%. They offer the sin offering, and they do 95% and fail to keep just a bit of it aside for themselves to eat, and we can assume what's God going to do? Maybe, right? I mean, that's certainly the example he set so far, and this isn't days, weeks later. We're in the same, you know, hour, right? Take the sons outside, bring in the other two off the bench. Let's keep going, okay? So they don't eat the sin offering as they were supposed to, okay? Moses now confronts Aaron and says, dude, what the heck? Jared, pick up there in 17.
Why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? For it is most holy, and he gave it to you to bear away the guilt of the congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, since its blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary, just as I commanded.
All right, so he reiterates to Aaron, this is how this was supposed to go down, okay? This is not news to Aaron, but he's reminding him, hey, offer it, you keep this aside, you and your sons should have eaten it in here, in the holy place, you don't leave, but you eat it on the spot. And Aaron's kind of standing there nodding like, I got it, I know, okay? 19, this is a fascinating response from Aaron, and I really want to pick this apart because it's beautiful, okay? Listen to his response. Jared, read that. Chapter over. Okay? It's kind of a strange ending. Okay? Now, what's going on here? Moses says to Aaron, you should have eaten it. Okay? Goes through all the laws, and Aaron goes, got it. And then in 19, he says, behold, this very day, they presented their sin offering, meaning Nadab and Abihu, third and fourth born sons, they presented their sin offering just as they were supposed to. When things like these happened to me, what is he speaking of? The death of my two sons. I'm in the middle of doing my job, obeying you just like you asked me to do, and my two sons die, justifiably so, God was right in taking their lives. In that context, Moses, if I had eaten a sin offering, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord? And Moses goes, what is Aaron saying? He's saying, I intentionally disobeyed God's law because it was the right thing to do. And Moses says, I agree. I'm assuming that's what he said. He nodded in Hebrew. There's no response. There's no, you're guilty. There's no, your other two sons are dead. Aaron, you're dead. So the assumption is Moses agrees with him. What is Aaron saying? Don't miss this, because this is the essential part of the law, and God says it right from the beginning. Exactly what he's saying. So is it okay to not go through all the correct external processes when internally you're jacked? Or is it better to not fake it on the outside and say, this is where I'm at, intentionally break the law of God because that was where Aaron's heart was and that was the right place? Right? That's what he's saying. God, I am grieved today. I am going through the process because this is my job. It's important. I get it. But I am not in a place to worship you right now. Okay? That's what eating the sin offering was. It was an act of worship. All of this was a sacrifice. And they were, in a sense, participating in that act of worship as priests by eating the sacrifice. So Aaron says, I can't do that. To do it externally, I can, and I can fake it if that's what you want me to do, God, but you don't want me to fake it. You would rather me break your laws than fake it on the outside. Now, look at these two stories, okay? Juxtaposed. You've got Eleazar and Itamar, okay? The second, or the third and fourth born sons, and the first two sons, Nadab and Abihu, okay? Nadab and Abihu, essentially, if you had to paint them in today's context as Christians, describe them for me. Insides versus outsides. Got the Bible, got, right, they got the right, they can speak the words, they can talk the talk, they look like sheep. But on the inside, they're rotten, right? They're hammered going in the sanctuary, okay? They kind of do their own thing, they disregard the law of God. They did all the externals correctly, right? Assuming that they didn't get the ingredient list wrong and they did everything else right, everything they did was technically correct. Exactly how God said to do it in the law. However, their hearts were jacked. They didn't care. They were like, eh, right? Grown up in a Christian home. I've been around the high priest my whole life, right? Things of God are kind of boring to me. I'm going through the motions, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, Dad, what do you want me to do? Does anyone else want to do this? Oh, no, I'm the only guy. Okay, thanks, right? No one else can do this anyway. They're hard. Now, paint that in contrast to Aaron and his other two sons as well, who you would assume the reason they didn't eat is because I think Dad's probably leading him in this process. What if, paint them as well. What do they look like? External, internal.
Well, at first class, they're disobeying. They're wrong.
Yeah, right? With what in context for them? What did they just see?
Death,
right? In the middle of their willingly choosing to disobey, they saw the consequences of disobeying as death, and they said, it's better for me to disobey on the outside when my heart's right and God will be honored in that as opposed to me faking it, going through the motions, and yet my heart being jacked. This is not the New Testament. This is the Old Testament, right? And God says, that's exactly what I expect in the law. Don't fake it and do all these external things even though your heart's jacked. I don't want any part of that. That's not why I created this system. I created a system so you could touch and see and smell and experience me when your hearts are right, okay? And if they're not right, then don't worship. And Aaron says, that's why I didn't do it, Moses. And Moses says, yep, I think you're right in that. So what I love about this story is you see the heart of the law, right? The heart of the law isn't rote, rigorous, do these things, check these boxes, and God's happy with you. That was never the intent of the law. The intent of the law was a, uh, it was a, it was a means to express how you felt on the inside, right? And what happened with Jews and what happens with us as Christians is we do the exact opposite. We do good, we try hard, and we fail. We do good, we try hard, and we fail. And then we say, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to do good, fake it, and make everyone else around me think I'm doing fine when I'm completely jacked on the inside. And God's like, I don't want any part of that. That's not what I want. That's never what I wanted. Even in the law, I've never wanted that. When we have grace and aren't, we don't have to offer sacrifices and check boxes and not shave our beards and do all the things that they had to do. God says from the beginning, that was never, ever, ever my heart, right? So, wonderful story. I love this because I think you see the heart of God in the midst of the law. And we so often confuse some of what's going on here and what God's heart actually is and all these things. That's not why he gave Israel all these things, okay? So, just to pull up a little bit in 30,000 feet and apply this to our lives. It's a phenomenal story, I think, of ultimately what God wants from all of us as believers. Walk with God, right? Be honest. Be who you are. And if you're not in a place to worship, if your heart's not right, get right with God first and don't worry about the externals. Don't fake it for people around you, right? That's such a temptation, especially for those of you guys that are going into ministry, right? That's hard. Or that are in leadership positions or are looked to. We have an expectation of ourselves. We have an expectation of what other people expect of us, right? It just, there's pressure. It's an odd deal. But God says, just be authentic. Be honest. Be real with who you are. What do you think that did, by the way, for all of the people that Aaron and his two sons now were leading in Moses? What example did they just show to the people? Yeah, this is what God wants. We're not going to fake it. We don't expect you to either, nor does God, right? And a leader had to go first and say, listen, there were drastic consequences in the balance when we made this decision. We didn't know if that would end in death for us. We just did what we felt God would want us to do based on what we know about the character of God and even disobeying laws that he gave us. But that's the spirit of the law. So what a great example in leadership to say, that's godliness, right? So they were able to point to those three guys and go, that's exactly how we should respond. Don't fake it. Be real. So in the midst of it, as you see all the, you see this tradition carried on for centuries to come, it gets pretty jacked and people go through motions. And, you know, you can go to Israel today and you can see a lot of people that know a ton about their Bibles and stuff. And yet externally, they look great. But internally, they don't care. Their motions and things they say and and then there's a lot of people that aren't that way, okay? But I think that's one of the beauties of this, all right? So thoughts on 8 through 10 before we move on in this story particularly. Takeaways for you guys.
Did you intentionally do the proverb that talks about external stuff and internal stuff?
No. I wish I was that smart, Callie, but I'm not. So thank you for trying to give me credit and not asking me another hard question. You may speak more today.
I think of my culture, the pastors take this story and really hold it to a level where they say, where they put church in front of family. And to see the sons, and, you know, I know it, but it's just like hearing you talk about it and just thinking about, like, I have relatives whose pastors and their kids are, like, locked up, like, you know, like, just because the father is putting the church ahead of the family. And so, yeah, that's all I was just saying, just thinking about all the people I know that's either dead or in jail, and their fathers are pastors, and I'm like, man, I don't think that.
Yeah. So. That's a hard balance, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think... Yeah, being thrown in jail for your faith is a whole other conversation. But especially you guys that are going into ministry, don't let ministry be your mistress, okay? It's very, very easy to do. It's very easy to do because you get feedback and accolades and you come out of the pulpit and people tell you how brilliant you are and how great you talk and whatever, right? It's easy to fall in the trap because that's where you get strokes, right? And home can be difficult and you're raising kids and they're whatever and life's hard and car's broken down and you know, I'll stay at the office until 9 o'clock, whatever. Okay, don't put ministry in front of that. And don't deceive yourselves into thinking that there isn't someone else that God could use in a heartbeat to do your job. In a heartbeat. God doesn't need any of you. and he certainly doesn't need me. He could replace me tomorrow. Now, what he can't replace, I'm the only kid, or only father to my kids, and I'm the only husband to my wives. To my wife. Gosh, one of those days.
Dave, let's go ahead and strike that last comment as well.
Wife. It's a serious moment, and it's ruined it. Mike, good job, see. That's why let me talk so much. Anyway, idea being this, you guys have certain unique roles in life. This isn't one of them for me, right? Anybody can do this, okay? I enjoy it, it's a lot of fun, and I hope I get to do it for a long time, but I'm replaceable, right? But I can't be replaced at home, okay? Lest I die and my wife has to remarry, but my kids still don't have a dad, and you know, some chump's gonna be the second husband of my wife, potentially. Hopefully that will never happen. But you guys get the what I'm trying to communicate, right? Don't put ministry above, don't put work above your family, okay? It's easy to do, especially for guys. So there's a good nugget of warning in that as well, okay? So, and I think Aaron did, what I see in this, Pete, just maybe to speak to that, I see Aaron leading his kids in a great way, right? He set an example of saying, I'm not eating that, burn it all. You know, I'm assuming what's happened behind the scenes, and he leads his family into that, okay? So, there are certain sermons that I have in my back pocket, right? This is one of those great ones. So when you're on a mission trip one day, and someone says, hey, Tony, can you preach in 15 minutes? You're like, yes, right? We were in Thailand on the way to church, right? We're in the back, me and Brad and like four other large guys in the back of a station wagon. And the guy turns around in the front seat and says, hey, Brad, you're teaching this morning at church. We're driving to church, right? And Brad's like, okay, you know, and it's Brad, so he can pull stuff off like that. The rest of us kind of wet ourselves and go, oh God, I need a week, you know. So, but there's certain, you want to have those ready. So guys, gals, both, for whatever, you know, it's good to have some text that you cling to or something that you can in 5 minutes get up and, you know, exposit God's word in 20 minutes. And it may not be perfect, but they rarely ever are. So be encouraged, okay? So tuck those away. That's one that I have that I just, it's a go-to for me and I think teaches some great lessons about freedom and grace in the Old Testament, oddly enough, okay? So, all right, 1 through 7. What's our title on that? Offerings, okay? 8 through 10, we're about to see a shift in 11, okay? We're gonna see less history and more of more Moses tell the people this and this and this and this, okay? So if you had 8 through 10, what are we talking about? Praying to worship.
Opening ceremonies.
Opening ceremonies. Okay, that's a good one. Who's the main people? Yeah, we're talking about the priesthood. Okay, so something like that. So 1 through 7 would be offerings. 8 through 10 would be opening ceremonies. Preparing the priests. Inaugurate. I don't know, something like that, right? So you guys pick your title. But 8 through 10 kind of fits together. And if you want to break those further down, maybe you get chapter 8, then chapter 9, then chapter 10. You can kind of break those down. They're each separate, okay? In 11, we're going to see a change, okay? And this is, boy, this is weird stuff, okay? In terms of, like, we're not so much as Christians used to this. And we're like, why did God write all this down? And he took a lot of time. And we see a lot of it repeated in Deuteronomy, okay? 11 and following, let's just get a feel for kind of where we're going, and then we'll pull up out of the minutia. But just start in 11 verse 1, and let's kind of watch where God is now going to take the people in terms of the laws. Right, this is where we're going, right? It's like, ugh, it feels like we're bogging down in mud right now, right? Here are the foods you can eat, okay? Notice chapter 11 goes all the way through verse 47. The whole chapter is about what we're reading right now. Here's the stuff you can eat. Here's what's on your menu. Here's what's not on your menu. Let me further clarify. Does its hoof like that? No, you can't eat that. Does its hoof look like this? Yes, you can eat that. But not this, 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 or this. Even though its hoof does look like that and not like that, you can't eat this because it's like this. You're like, what? Okay, so God's going to spend a whole chapter in chapter 11 talking about food. Here's what you can eat. Here's what you cannot eat. Okay? Dietary laws, right? In verses, I'll do a little bit of, you know, heavy lifting for you guys. In verses 1 through 8, we're talking about land animals. Here are the things that walk on the earth that you can and cannot eat. Okay? And you see some of the divisions that God uses and why he uses these. I don't know, but he does. Okay? If it divides a hoof and as a result has split hooves and chews the cud, among those animals you may eat. Okay? And then he begins to give a list. Or kind of the exceptions to that rule. The safran in verse 5, for though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof, it's unclean. The rabbit, though it chews the cud, meaning it appears to chew and then swallow like a cow, and then spit it back up, you can't eat that, right? And the pig, even though it divides the hoof, thus making it a split hoof, it does not chew the cud, so it's unclean to you. So you can't eat that. That's clean, that's unclean. That's clean, that's unclean, okay? The list of things that they can eat, obviously we've seen sheep, goats, rams, deer are on that menu. I think Deuteronomy 14 gives like an actual list of what they can eat. The ibex was clean. Okay, so they're giving clean animals. Okay, clean versus unclean. So let's talk about that for a second. By the way, chapter 11, verse 1 to the end of chapter 15, the words clean and unclean are used over 100 times. In 5 chapters. 100 times. So do you think that concept's fairly important? Clean versus unclean. So what are we talking about? What in the world does clean and unclean mean to a Jew? Why is God saying this? What does that mean in their context? You need to take a shower when you're done eating that because it makes you unclean or you smell or like what's the deal? Good. This is different for us, right? It's a weird concept.
You're unfit to worship the Lord?
Exactly. You're unfit to worship God, okay? So clean and unclean is, hey, green light to go to church? Nope, you got to stay home, okay? Green light to fellowship with the people around you? Or nope, you're staying home from life group tonight, okay? That's the idea. There were certain things that were allowable that made you have the ability to go into the sanctuary, to commune with God, and to fellowship with others. Okay, that was the idea. That's all of the clean and unclean. Now, God wasn't just giving them these arbitrary rules to say, you know what, not a fan of pigs, I kind of messed up on that one, so we're going to make that one unclean just for the heck of it, but these other animals are better. That's not what he's doing. Okay, he's making them obey the law, and there's also dietary reasons. There's animals that are filthy that he says, don't eat that, right? We're going to see in 9 through 12, he gives them waterborne animals that they can and can't eat. Some of them are just nasty, and you don't want to eat them, right? They're infectious, disease-carrying, filthy animals. Some of them, not all of them, right? You know, obviously in Acts 2, we see the doors open. Not Acts 2. Later on in Acts, when Peter sees the vision of the sheets, everything becomes clean with Cornelius. Thank you. But there are some things he just says, listen, these are infectious. For your own safety, don't eat them, okay? And he doesn't say it like that, but the idea is he's going to separate Israel from the people around them in terms of what the pagans are eating, and dietetically, these are healthy for them, if you will. They're going to keep them from disease, okay? But the whole point behind is clean and unclean, okay? And we're going to see that not with just food, but we're going to see that with a ton of other issues in life, okay? So chapter 11 is all about the food, okay? 1 through 8, okay, land animals. 9 through 12, you get what's in the water, okay? And they can't eat some. Verse 9, these you may eat, whatever's in the water. All that have fins and scales, those in the water, in the seas of the rivers you may eat, okay? We're going to go to the Sea of Galilee, and we're going to go eat fish. It's kosher. It's all good, okay? Don't be like Christian Warren, who went to the Sea of Galilee and had a pizza. That's horrible, okay? If you don't like fish, eat one in your life and enjoy it, okay? We're going to go eat St. Peter's fish, okay, when we're there. And you can put in front of you, like, full-on fish form, like there's the eyeball and there's the tail. That's how Ronan will eat it, and they'll show you how to dissect it. It's magical. Or you can get a fillet where they do all the hard work for you, and it looks like a normal fish like we would eat today. So, okay? For those of you guys that are opposed to fish, I'll instruct you, and you can get that one, okay? Anyway, so there are certain types of fish. They obviously had fishermen. That was a normal part of what they did. In Israel, there are fish that are clean. Rivers, they have scales. Those are clean, okay? However,
Whatever is in verse 10, the seas that does not have fins and scales, all that are teeming in the life of the water, that among the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable things to you. They shall be abhorrent to you. They shall you shall not eat their flesh or carcasses, or you shall detest whatever is in the water that does not have fins and scales is abhorrent to you. Okay, so eels, new. Okay, no fins. Okay, you can't in those scales. You don't get to eat those. Okay, you can imagine and expand the list. If it doesn't have fins and doesn't have scales, it's not edible. Okay, so you can think of all the other things that live in the ocean that would have been off limits to a Jew because of that. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, 13 through 23, this is the stuff in the air. Okay, so flying things. 13 through 19 is birds. And then 20 through 23, you're going to get insects. Okay, so there were obviously some types of insects that were kosher. John the Baptist ate some and did okay. Probably not the most enjoyable for any of us. If you've ever been on mission trips, you maybe have gotten a chance to eat insects. It's different, not a part of our culture, but you know what? It is for some, okay? So 13 through and following, you get birds that you can eat and some that you can, some that you can't. Okay, we won't go through them all. Verse 20, all winged insects that walk on all fours are detestable to you, yet these you may eat among the winged insects which walk on all fours. In verse 21, okay? 22, you see the locust. That was edible. Okay, so John the Baptist was good. Okay, probably not top on any of our, like, gosh, I hope we get to have locusts for lunch, but they could. They were good. The cricket and grasshoppers and all kinds. Okay, so if you were part of the, you know, late 90s cricket infestation in Texas, dude, you'd have been in good shape, okay? You could have survived on those for a long time, okay? And you wouldn't have been competing with anybody. They were there, okay, in numerous amounts, okay? So that is chapter 11, okay? Food, clean and unclean.
What is one after the longest? Like,
what verse are we in?
The same one. 22.
Mine says cricket. What does yours say? I don't have, yeah, mine's, I have a different translation. Yeah, I've got locust, devastating locust, cricket, grasshopper. So you have a weird name that we can't pronounce. Super, good. Right, and there's a lot of those. There's a rock badger. What is that? Verse 5, did you guys notice in 11:5? The saffron, what the heck is a saffron? Like, I don't know. I have a picture of one, found one in Israel, never seen one before. Yeah, a coney. Coney Island is named after those. They have these little critters that look like fat squirrels. Like, think squirrels, but like times four. They're these kind of like a raccoon size animal, but looks like a squirrel, color-wise. Yeah, they're kind of cute. I mean, you go, oh, I'm going to take a picture of that, right? But they could, those are, they're prevalent in Israel, okay? So. Yeah, right. Like, what? It's good context, Callie. They're like, yeah, any of that. Give me a locust, anything other than manna. So that's true, Callie. Good point, right? Here's all the things that in 40 years you can eat, but not right now. So, yeah, good point, okay? But, yeah, that's it. So that had to be a little frustrating. There ain't no grasshoppers where they're at, so yeah, there is. There ain't no nothing. So that was not their problem, I assure you. So, and God probably did that because they would have eaten it, you know, ravenously. So, but yeah, okay. So, gang, that's chapter 11. Food, all the stuff you can and can't eat. Okay, last two verses, 46 and 47. Okay, kind of give you a bit of a theme, if you will, or a summation of the food process. So. Rachel, read 46 and 47 there.
This is the law regarding the animal and the bird, and every living thing that moves in the waters, and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten.
Yeah, so all the animals on the earth, your job is to discern between the clean and the unclean. And whose ultimate job was it to discern those two things? The priest. Can I eat? Is this okay, Aaron? Oh, good. Okay, yeah. Let me see. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's a horrid locust. That's okay. No, wait. Nope. That's all fours and does this and freaky and no. Okay. Don't eat that. Okay. Now, by the way, this isn't sin per se. There's no like, it makes you unclean, and there was a process for coming unclean, but this wasn't like, thou shalt not murder. This isn't the same level, okay? So these are dietary laws to keep them safe. Excuse me. They were certainly to be obeyed, so they weren't optional, but this wasn't like, you're in sin. Now, it took them out of fellowship with God. It took them out of fellowship with one another. So, you know, it's a big deal, but these aren't like heavy-handed sin issues, if you will, okay? So just keep that in mind as we read through a couple of these, okay? And these get progressively weirder and grosser and some that I'm not even sure that we can read in a co-ed context, okay? Seriously, there's weird stuff in Leviticus, okay? But I guess God taught it to 1.5 million people together, so maybe we can too, okay? 12, let's talk about childbirth, okay? Shorter chapter, and this is odd, okay? Thank goodness, because, yeah, okay? Yeah, you like that? Woo-hoo. This isn't the weird chapter either, okay? 12:1. I may have you read that for homework. See, now you guys are dying to read Leviticus. See, you never thought that would happen. Oh, what's the weird stuff? I want to read it. 12:1, pick up there. Okay, so you have a kid, and you're considered unclean. I thought like kids were like a gift. I thought this was a good thing, and this culture was good to have kids. Why would you be unclean?
It's nasty.
It's nasty, okay? So just to be gut-level honest, there, if you hadn't seen childbirth, you haven't had eighth-grade biology, right, and seen the film, there's fluids, there's stuff, there's, yeah, right? They look like little aliens when they come out. They do not look normal, okay? They are slobbery and whatever, okay? So the idea is there is... This will be important for later in Leviticus. When there are exchanges of fluid involved, okay, and other people around, those fluids are considered unclean. The child is not unclean, okay? Giving birth to a male or female child is not bad, obviously, but it would make a woman unclean, okay? Notice, verse 2, a male child, you're unclean for how long?
7 days,
okay? And then, on the 8th day, what happens? Circumcised. So according to the law, 8 days later, you get your male child circumcised. And then verse 4, she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days. So 7 plus 33, you have a male child, you are unclean for 40 days. Okay? She shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. So for 40 days, she can't even go near the tent of meeting. Now, I was looking at this morning. Again, women don't go inside the tabernacle, but they could fellowship outside. They weren't allowed there. They couldn't present their offering to become unclean or to become clean again to the priest outside or at the doorway of the tent of meeting underneath the authority and the headship of her husband. They couldn't even do that for 40 days. Okay, so they were out. Okay, now real quick, turn to Luke 22 and see if this puts some context for you. Sorry, Luke 2, 22. Okay. And watch what Mary was doing after she had baby Jesus. Pick up in verse 21. So what does Mary do? 8th day? Circumcises her kid. Why? How long ago did the law say that? Thousands of years, right? Exodus was 1446, so we're talking like 1400 years ago. And Mary cares about that enough to circumcise her kid on the 8th day. Now think about that. Our country's a couple hundred years old, right? Our laws aren't that old. We're 5 times as old as our country's even been around. Those laws came, and she says, nope, I'm to obey that because I am a Jew. Love God. That is what we do, okay? Days of her purification were completed. They brought him up to Jerusalem, as is written in the law for the Lord. Every firstborn male that opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. Right? We read that in Numbers. They were the firstborn of God, right? And the Levites took their place. Okay, but she sees that as significance, as significant. Verse 24, what does she do now? Okay, why would she offer a sacrifice? After her days of purification were over, 40 days, what does she do? She wants to be clean. Why? I want fellowship with God, and I want fellowship with others again. So I have to offer a sacrifice. And she gave what? Turtle doves and a pigeon, because they were poor. So tell me about the type of family that Jesus grew up in. It's a God-fearing family. Tell me about Joseph. You don't even read about Joseph in here. What was he like? You think he led his family? His wife knows this stuff. His wife's leading through that, right? Certainly here's a guy that fears God. So, boy, you talk about a great earthly father. Jesus had one, right? Now, his heavenly father was obviously God, but, boy, he had a dad in the home that walked with God, that feared the Lord, that did the things that the Bible said to do. That's the home he grew up in. And they were dirty poor and happy, right? So just cool to see, you know, 1,400 years later, they're still obeying the law, and that was the family that Jesus grew up in, okay? So again, back to Leviticus chapter 12, male child, 7 days, okay? Just like, and it compares this to the idea of a woman's menstrual cycle, that you would have been unclean for 7 days. Add on 33 for the male, you're 40 days now unpure, okay? Or unclean. Verse 5 now, female child. Jane, pick up there. So 2 weeks, so we have 14 days, plus an additional 66 days. If you have a female child, you are unclean for... Thank you, Layla. Somebody with a calculator, 14 plus 66 is 80. Twice as long as a male, right? Male's 40. That was a good answer. It was technically correct. Wow. You guys seen those things on Pinterest where it's like the test that kids get and it says, yeah, name the objects, and there's like a circle and a parallelogram and a whatever, and they say, Bob, Sue. Yeah. I named them. Why don't I get credit for that, right? You said name them. I did. My wife shows me Pinterest frequently. I do not have a Pinterest account. I would own it if I did. They're also on Facebook, which is where I saw them, so just to be clear. But my wife shows me those frequently on Pinterest. This is what I get at 8:30 at night when I'm trying to go to sleep. My wife's in bed with her phone. honey, look at... What? Hey, baby, I got residency in the morning. I don't want to see your Pinterest account. Yeah, the bed shakes because she's laughing so hard. Okay, back to this, okay? 40 days for a guy, 80 days for a female. Why? Why are you unpure longer for having a female child? Because she's female. Men are better than women. And that's what the... I'm teasing. I have absolutely no idea. I'm kidding. I don't know. For whatever reason, that's how God did it. Okay? So maybe they're more holy and they take longer to purify. I don't know. Okay? But that's how God set it aside. So I do not have a good reason as to why that was the case. So, okay? There you go. Just try to make some of you mad. All right? But the idea is 6 and following, you complete your purification. Again, 40 or 80, depending on what child you had. And now you can fellowship with God and man again. Okay? Cool? So chapter 11 is about animals, food, whatever. Chapter 12 is about childbirth. Okay? Those are good titles. 13, okay? Odd chapter. This is all about leprosy. Okay? We don't deal with this in our day and age much anymore. Leprosy is probably not the best catch-all category. This would have been any external skin ailment, leprosy included, okay? The idea was, if you were an individual and you're living in a community very closely with other people and something breaks out on your body, right? You have poison ivy tomorrow, okay? What are you hoping that that person with poison ivy does? Go away, right? So they would go and show it to the priest and say, this wasn't here yesterday. It itches a little bit and there's pus and there's hair coming out of it that's now turned white. Aaron, what do you think about that? And Aaron would go, no bueno. 7 days, okay? You go hang out there. Come back in 7 days. I'll look at it again. If it's normal and the itching subsided, right, and it's not pussy and oozy, then you can come back in, okay? Notice chapter 13. See how long it is? 59 verses on pussy, oozy, scabby sores. And the idea was... Makes me so happy. The idea was, if you had any ailment, you took it immediately to the priest. And what was the priest's job? Their job was to discern between, no, it looks okay. No, it's just a scab and it's healing. You got a boo-boo, you're good. No big deal. You can go fellowship with others and live in close proximity with other people. Or, I'm not sure, ooh, I think that's leprosy. Let's remove you from the camp and we'll reevaluate. Aaron had his own tent outside of the tent of meeting. Okay, so you've got, tabernacle.
Yeah.
He had a tent that he lived in next to his sons and their family right outside of the tabernacle. So they would come to his tent and say,
oh, okay.
Hey, dude, I woke up with this.
And then,
no, not in the, yeah.
No.
Not inside the tabernacle.
Right.
They would meet and then they would. Well, think about that. Everybody would see you. Because what just happened to Layla with her skin ailment? Hey, where's Layla? Has anyone seen her? Oh, she went to go see Aaron. Now she's outside the camp for 7 days. And it may be a simple thing, and out of concern, they just removed you to make sure. Or it may be, ooh, you know, she's got poison ivy, or she has leprosy, or whatever. But why would you remove people? Think hygienically. Why is that important? Yeah, you're going to infect everybody if you don't. So the idea was, we're going to protect everyone else around you. We're going to keep it clean, okay?
So when they would go outside the camp for 7 days, would they have a tent? Or like, how would they
live? Yeah, it doesn't look like they're banished or evil. Again, it's not like you're horrid, you know, leave our presence. It's, yeah, you're just going to be.
So they'd like set up a tent outside?
Yeah, you're isolated and just living away from others. Or you're living with others that potentially have the same ailment you do, right? Now you can all share your poison ivy and whatever, okay? So, yeah.
If they were to travel at this time, would they just have to travel behind the pack?
Yeah, it's not covered, but I assume that they would be separated. Yeah. Yeah. Okay?
There's like, how many people are camped there right now? Like
1.5 to 3 million.
And Aaron's the only guy?
And his sons.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you've got the JV priest and. You get from the text, obviously, you've got Aaron's uncle's kids. Or was it his brother's kids? No, it was his uncle. So those weren't his nephews, were they? His uncles were. Family trees, cousins, thank you. Gosh, family trees are so hard for me. You wouldn't think it'd be that difficult.
Now,
but I am from Texas.
I was wondering, because that many people, that's probably like a line.
Right?
Of people.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Next. Uzi Pussy, you're out. Right? But literally, that. I mean, you think about the day-to-day operations of their job, that's what they did, right? That's an odd job. So you are the you're the triage nurse of Israel. Yeah, that's bad. No, that's okay. Yeah,
would
you're.
Did the priest ever get that? Did he ever?
Yeah, at times a priest can become unclean, which is why they said, don't leave the tabernacle or you'll be unclean. And their consequence in that specific instance was death. But yeah, they can become unclean as well. Which is fascinating, by the way, when you read the parable of the Good Samaritan. Uh-huh. The reason that the priest didn't stop, I don't want to become unclean. I got a job to do. My job is really important. Helping you would be problematic for me.
Wait, was he going to or coming back from?
Coming back from, but he still didn't want to become unclean. It's a pain. So I got to sit out 7 days out of the camp. I got to get the bag. I got through this whole process. That's a pain. So, but it's fascinating with that in context to think, how would a priest be thinking? I've got a job to do. Very important, right? What if I get called off the bench and I have to come minister? Like, I got to be outside the camp for now 7 days or rituals and all the stuff and the bathing and like there's a whole chapters on here's how you become clean. Here's what you have to do, right? So it's a pain, okay? So 11, we got food. 12, we got childbirth. 13, we got leprosy and other skin ailments, okay? Now, if you guys really want to on your own, feel free to spend your quiet times talking about scabs, verse 6, spreading of scabs, Rachel, the white swelling in verse 10 that comes from scabs, boils. I think pus is mentioned, reddish white spot. I mean, it's good, okay? Can you imagine? Yeah. The goal of that sermon would get the first person to pass out, and then you're like, okay, we're done. Okay? Right? Yeah. Yeah, okay? 14, by the way. So 13 is leprosy. 14 is about the cleansing from leprosy, okay? Oh, Rachel wants to talk about mildew, okay? Where's mildew? 59. We're skipping mildew.
Oh,
leprosy, garment of wool. You said 59?
Mine says 1347. What? Oh,
Right, all of it. Their homes had to be cleaned a certain way, right? So they didn't get funky homes, right? You couldn't live in filth. So these were clean people, right? Again, that's why the whole, I told you guys about the plague in Europe. That's, God made them be clean. So, you know, get your dustbuster and your broom and wipe down your stuff with bleach, and that's how they lived, okay? I think Hansen's disease is the official deal, not like it was then. You guys are familiar with leper colonies and stuff like that. I think there are still places, but it is very, very uncommon today. That's right. They've come up with it's a curable disease now and wasn't years and years and years ago. So, yeah. We had Darlene Hansen in here one year who's a nurse. She was like, thank you. So, yeah, very handy to have. I am not a nurse, okay? 14 is all about the cleansing from leprosy. We're going to skip that. We should probably read it just so I don't have to teach you guys 15, but dang it. There's some cool imagery in 14 that we're going to get into later that I want to save, okay? So, this is not what you guys want in your head when we leave for Christmas break, okay? Okay. Don't tell anybody I taught you Leviticus 15, and we'll be okay. I mean, you probably just need to turn this off. All right, so 15 is all about bodily issues, okay? So what do you have when you have, in 13 and 14, or 13 at least, we're covering like skin ailments and normal stuff, okay? 15:1, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man specifically, has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean, okay? If you have a different version of your Bible, it doesn't say body, male organ would be probably more correct term, maybe not so PC. I was looking at multiple versions of the Bible this morning. One of them said penis, okay? So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about sexually transmitted diseases, okay? How about that, chapter 15, okay? And other ailments that would come from, this case, a male, and females are covered later, okay? But that's the idea, okay? Some think that the beginning of this is dealing specifically with gonorrhea, or, you know, but that's the type of, like, God's covering that in the law. Are you kidding me, right? All of it, okay? If that discharge, verse 1, comes out of them, everything he touches shall be unclean, okay? You see in verse 4, every bed that he touches, everything that comes in contact with him is unclean. He who touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. Wherever you sat was unclean. Can you imagine, right? The couch that you sat on, the chair that you ate lunch at, everything's unclean. And by the way, if you came and ate lunch after that guy and sat on his chair, now you're unclean for, like, it's a big deal to be unclean. And it can be pretty filthy and frustrating, right? And touching someone that's unclean or something that they touched that they made unclean made you unclean. So, and certain ailments were bigger than others, okay? So, that's the idea, okay? So you get all these discharges in here that make you unclean. Let's see. This is all 10, 9, 10, 11, saddles and everything, right? It's all unclean, okay? So it's more on that, okay? In exchange of slight, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, if you've ever seen Hebrews talk, you would, yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's they are very vocal. They're like Italians. And they're much more guttural, so it's not as pretty of a language either. So I don't know. So maybe that or maybe a like, physical, like, okay. I don't know. Playing a game of pickup basketball and someone got mad and spit on somebody. Yeah, I don't know. But saliva would have made you unclean as well, okay? Let's see, verse 13, when the man with the discharge becomes cleansed from his discharge, he shall count off for himself 7 days for his cleansing. He shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in running water and become clean, okay? You get more prescriptions here of clean and unclean. Here comes the fun stuff. You guys ready? Woo! 16, if a man has a seminal emission, he shall bathe himself in water and be unclean until morning. So, sex between a husband and wife, though a godly and honorable thing, made you unclean, okay? So think about that in context, husbands and wives.
if you are going to worship, like, you had to think through, you were unclean until evening, okay? So it was like you couldn't go worship or be in the presence of others that until the sun went down, okay? So it would have kept you out of fellowship and worship, okay? So even your marital life was secondary to your worship of God, okay? Your fellowship with your... Yes, and I want to say that one was unclean longer. No, 18. If a man lies with a woman so that there's a seminal emission, they shall both bathe in water and be unclean until morning. Okay? So, again, fluids made you unclean. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. Okay? 19 and following, you get a woman's menstruation all the way through 24. This is if it made her unclean. Okay, whoever touched her was also unclean. If you slept with a woman while she was menstruating, you became unclean. Some people have taken that today to say it's sin to have sex with your spouse while they are menstruating. Y'all can figure that out on your own. I'm not here to solve that theology for you, okay? But anyway, so this is, again, welcome to Leviticus and the details that it gives in terms of life and living and being in close proximity with other people and how you were to handle that. Yep.
You were saying in the beginning that it looks like gonorrhea or something like that. Do you think it sounds like a sexually transmitted disease because of like different wives, multiple partners? That was kind of more common back then?
I don't think so, because they're not a, this isn't like, yeah, it's not a promiscuous type of lifestyle. They were the opposite of that. Now, multiple wives would have been potential, so I guess within your family that could happen. The idea is that the wording for body and the ideas are very different than chapter 13 of sores and whatever. We're talking about male-specific stuff. Then female-specific menstruation, like these are those parts, okay? So, all right. Yeah, okay. Again, more on discharges from women 25 and following, her menstruation, the period of that, how she becomes clean, but you're unclean during your menstrual cycle, and all of that, okay? So that's the idea. That's chapter 15, okay? We'll keep it on the up and up as best we can. So, okay. So if you had to take a step back and say, 11's food, 12 is childbirth, 13 is leprosy, various skin ailments, 14 is the cure for those. What's 15? Bodily something. We'll keep it above board. Okay. Right. Grossness stuff. 11 through 15. Hang on. Shingle on that for me. What are we talking about? What's the theme of 11 through 15?
Hygiene,
right? Specifically, clean and unclean, okay? So, at this point, if you're a Jew, what do you have a really good concept of? Clean and unclean, right? And you've got a tabernacle, you've got priests, you've got a system, and then God tells you everything that makes you clean and unclean, which involved getting right with God, and you had to go through these processes, so... that's important to note in terms of what we're going to study when we get back from break, okay? God gives them five chapters of, y'all are unclean, okay? Do you think anybody obeyed all this or was never unclean, right? It's nigh unto impossible not to bump someone's elbow that had a scab or to have one yourself or to eat the wrong thing or to whatever. Like, this is a big deal, and it had to be on your mind continually so as to not become unclean. Before I forget, because my brain's small. When you were unclean, by the way, you had to announce that to everyone around you. In chapter 13, it talks about the priests, when they would exile someone from the community, they had to shout, unclean, unclean, right? So nobody would touch them. So they were, the priest has said, you're unclean, you're now out of the camp, tell everyone else around you. Okay, so it was very public. Yep, your host. Sorry, dude. So go see Aaron, and you'll be out here with me in a few minutes. So, yeah.
Yep.
right? That had to be awful, like some issue that is incurable that didn't allow you to go to church. And I think the application side of that is what's fascinating to me. Where does she go as soon as she becomes clean? She goes to worship. That, like, that's what matters to her, right? I am out of fellowship with God, and I want to be. That's the reason of wanting to become clean, right? So it's a neat story.
Saddle. Gods.
Yeah.
Do you understand? Like, he can't even touch her.
Yeah.
So she, like, he had no chance.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think of all the things that God could have made commentary about with idols. Like, that's already unclean. And then to put an idol underneath that.
Would they have known that then?
Not to the same degree, but I'm sure that there would have been a respect of privacy. And I think certain cultural norms would have been probably in place. Formally, no. Not in their day and age. We're still hundreds of years before the law with Abraham, but there would have certainly been a sense of knowing. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So, enjoy your Christmas break. Have fun. So, we will see you guys 3 weeks. Okay. We'll pick up back in Leviticus. Enjoy your quiet times at 4 in the morning. Just three. Jane.